You have discovered the Felon File. FelonFile.com is a podcast exploration and discussion of law enforcement, history, issues, and incidents in the Appalachian Mountains and elsewhere. Felon File is hosted by Scott Lunsford, retired police detective, sergeant, author and researcher. The Shade of Blue story for Felon File today. Do the ends justify the means? Gaston Means, teacher school superintendent. Salesman extraordinarily. Liar. FBI agent. Treasury and custom agent. Con man. Spy. Thief and possibly murder. Or a misunderstood southern gentleman who just wanted to help. Scott has the scoop on this strange man. Background music. Hard Boiled, hosted by Purple Planet. Scott, the microphone is on and we're recording.
Thank you, Victoria, for opening up the podcast tonight. And if you listen to Victoria, you have a pretty good idea on who we are and what we do. And if you have listened to us before, you also know who we are and what we do, but try not to hold that against us. For this particular Shade of Blue story on Felon File, we're following up on a request from Tamar in Beersheba, Israel. She was interested in a Shade of Blue story on a southern gentleman con man, as she referred to him in her email, a slick fellow out for the money, but not a killer. Well, unfortunately, after digging around a little bit on him, I did find out that more than likely he was our murderer as well, but we're gonna still talk about him anyway. So this is for you, Tamar. The southern gentleman she was referring to, and I use the term very loosely, was involved in a lot of schemes and, as I said, a very suspicious death. I had heard of the man before, but Tamar sent me digging deeper, and I had found out just how interesting, conniving, and dangerous and full of it he was. His FBI file is now open, and you can peruse it. And after two FOIA requests, later on when I got the information, I found out just how interesting this guy was. Now, our Shade of Blue story is about a man from North Carolina who was once a teacher, a school administrator, a very excellent salesman. He would regularly bring in to the equivalent of over $100,000 a year for just his part-time work selling towels. Yeah, he was a towel salesman, but apparently he was very good at it. Detective, spy, not for the United States, but for Germany right before the United States entered World War I. And more than likely, as I said, a murderer and a con man. Not involved with the actual crimes, but he was able to embed himself into several historic famous investigations, like the Lindbergh kidnapping, the Teapot Dome scandal of Warren G. Harding's administration, even the possible assassination of the President of the United States. J. Edgar Hoover knew him and wasn't a fan. And literally, Hoover didn't like this guy. And at one point, they were rivals in the FBI. If you look in the dictionary under "You can't make this blank stuff up," you'll find a picture of Gaston Bullock Means. Gaston Means is one of those guys that was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, or at least he thought he was. About 1879, July 11th, 1879 is when he was born. His dad was a North Carolina lawyer and mayor of Concord, North Carolina, as well as a state representative at one point. Dad was a fast talker and one of those guys whose name you toss out like a switchblade when confronted with a legal issue. You know the type. My attorney is so-and-so and we're gonna sue the pants off of you. Unless he's Perry Mason, I don't want to hear it. Dad was a good provider though, and kind of had to be. Gaston had seven brothers and sisters growing up. Well, the apple didn't fall too far away from the tree. His father was called Colonel Means, and his grandfather was referred to as General Means, and I think he actually was a general. They were very well-known lawyers and had very strong reputations as fairly nasty in how they conducted their business whenever they needed to be. Gaston developed into that same nasty streak that he inherited. When a young man of about 10 or so, he would hang out at the courthouse and eavesdrop on the jurors and witnesses for trials that his father was involved with. He would follow potential jurors and report back to Dad whenever he'd find something of interest or something his father could use. He was apparently quite good at it. One of his uncles was, in fact, a Secret Service agent for the United States, and little Gaston wanted to grow up and be a detective and secret agent just like his uncle. And he somewhat accomplished that, I guess. Gaston and his brothers had a bit of a reputation with the Concord, North Carolina town people. When he became a bit famous, or infamous, neighbors interviewed by the press would later describe Gaston and his brothers as, quote, meaner than hell. Now, in interviews himself, Gaston claimed that growing up, one of his fondest memories was stealing money from his mother that she had put aside for a church charity and watching as the maid of the household was fired for suspicion of being the thief. Gaston Means did a lot of stuff along those lines as he was growing up. He went to the University of North Carolina for a while, but dropped out at the end of his third year for some sort of infraction or incident he was called into the carpet for the Faculty Discipline Board. It's unknown exactly what that was, but he wasn't expelled. He just decided he wasn't going to go to school anymore. It was after this when he became a teacher in an elementary school system in Albemarle, North Carolina. Now, this was before the need for licensed teachers. The town was pretty much run by the Cannon Textile Mill that was located there. The president was a friend of his father's and the company lawyer as well. Not to mention, the son of the president and several other Albemarle bigwigs were fraternity brothers of Gaston Means. He did well enough there that they made him head of the school system. He was a school administrator, top dog over the school system for about 2 years. Later, he took up this position working directly for Cannon Mills as a salesman. And the way that he had of opening people up, that talent of trickery and deceit, and that disarming Southern gentleman manner moved him later into the detective side work he became somewhat famous for. Now, leaving the sales job, and he had to before he was told to leave, apparently he had been caught impersonating and telling other people he was the president of the textile company's son. He was given the opportunity to quit before he got fired. In 1914, while still in New York, where he had been working for the textile company, he joined William J. Burns' detective agency in New York City. Burns was the former chief of the U.S. Secret Service, and of course he was the rival for the famous Pinkerton Detective Agency. He was able to convince Burns he could expand his business and gave him a few examples of exactly how. And that got him in the door, and he ended up being very profitable for not only himself, but for the Burns Investigative Agency. Now, while working for the Burns Investigative Agency, in 1950, he also began working for the German government at the start of World War I. He was reporting on armament shipments to Britain and other. He was able to get representatives for the German government jobs on the pier and in the shipbuilding areas so that they could report back to Germany on armament shipments, the construction of military vessels, etc., and so on. Now, there is some question as to his involvement at that time when he was working for Germany with the Burns Detective Agency. Burns himself said he had not been employed at that time. Depending on who you asked or what file you read, Gaston Means said at some points he did work for Burns at that time, and at some points he said he didn't. You had to take almost everything this guy said with a grain of salt. Actually, probably a lot more than just a grain. The official records and Means' detective license with the state of New York mysteriously disappeared in a moving of records, according to the FBI files. Yeah, go figure. That seemed to happen a lot with this guy. The ethics of providing information to help German U-boats find their targets didn't seem to concern Means or his boss at the time, William Burns. The United States wasn't yet involved in the war, and they rationalized it out that they weren't breaking any laws officially. And it didn't hurt that both of them apparently were paid very well for the information, about $100,000 a year. Again, a very large amount, even by today's standards. Now, going back to work directly for the Burns Investigative Agency, in 1917, Gaston Means was assigned an investigation involving a widow by the name of Maud A. King. She was the widow of a rich lumber businessman from Chicago, and it also happened that she was a friend of Gaston's wife. King had become the victim of an English con man who was blackmailing the widow over some issues or incidents that had occurred in Europe at the time. Means, doing his southern gentleman to the rescue bit, put a quick end to the con man's work. Unfortunately, Gaston Means stepped in and started his own con, draining money as he could from Miss King's accounts himself. The dead husband, Mr. James King, lumber baron, had only left his widow just part of his estate, enough to support her what he thought would be in the way she had become accustomed to. But apparently she wanted to become accustomed to a more rich environment. Around $70,000 a year is what he left her. You put that into modern money, 2021 dollars, which is really nothing to snicker at. Most of his other money was held in a trust for various charities he had supported in his lifetime. Now, discovering this, Means, of course, decided that he needed a cut of that particular money, and he was able to create a new will with a more recent date of signature and took the matter to court, all for Miss King and her own welfare, no doubt. The court set aside the original will and went along with the fake one, giving all of the money that was left at one time to the widow King. Now, being the gentleman he was, Means assisted the widow in managing her newfound wealth. And it didn't take long for Miss King to realize that there was some money missing from the accounts, a few dollars anyway. Well, let's say $400,000, to be a little more precise. Now, still trusting Gaston Means and thinking someone else was actually taking the funds, she advised him that she had discovered this and was going to report it to the police. Means, assuring her he would handle the situation, he invited the widow to Concord, North Carolina, his hometown, where he still owned property, for an old-fashioned southern barbecue and rabbit hunt. Now, going to the old family place, he set up the big event, food, guests, and of course, a little bit of rabbit hunting. Now, the widow was not familiar with firearms, and the host even went so far as to buy her own shotgun or rabbit gun for the hunt. Now, business about the missing money was going to be handled there, meeting with individuals and signing papers related to the missing money. He advised Miss King it had to be handled down south to not tip off the northern thieves who had been in her account. All perfectly logical, yeah, or at least it was when Gaston Means explained it to Mrs. King. Now, once in Concord, in the day before the big party was supposed to happen, Gaston suggested a night hunt. Now, depending on what file you read, or what records, or what newspaper articles you read, some indicated they were going to go for a night hunt for rabbits, while others stated that it was some target practice for her to learn how to shoot and get ready for the hunt the next day. According to the statement that Gaston Means made to the authorities later, he placed her shotgun in the crook of a tree and told her specifically not to touch it. But you know how that thing goes. She touched it anyway and managed to shoot herself in the head. Actually, the back of the head, according to a second autopsy that was performed later. After the accident, let's just call it a shotgun discharge, Means took the widow to town and sought out medical assistance. Unfortunately, she passed away from the gunshot blast. Now, suspicions, of course, were raised, but the coroner ruled at the time that the incident was just a terrible accident. This, of course, didn't sit well with Mrs. King's family, who petitioned the court for another medical exam after the body had been returned up north. The medical exam was granted, and it was noted in this second exam the absence of gunshot residue around the wound, showing that the gun was held farther away, actually too far away to have shot herself. This information and other findings were presented to a North Carolina grand jury who issued a true bill for murder. A trial was set to be held in Concord, North Carolina. The trial itself became almost a second civil war. Defense counsel claimed that outsiders from up north, i.e. the Yankees, were persecuting this poor local boy. The man was just doing his duty to help out a widow lady who was having problems and was a victim of no doubt other Yankee bad guys. Oh, and of course the German espionage agents were also trying to slander the local hero for his heroic efforts to work as a double agent to protect the United States of America. Yeah, that's stretching things. Now, on December 16th, 1916, after a 15-20 minute deliberation, the jury acquitted Means, found him not guilty. So, Means went back to New York, where the big money was, to work again once more for the Burns Agency. Now, the courts took another look at that will that Gaston had assisted with and had brought before the court that was alleged to have been signed after the original will. Now, after examination, the will was declared a forgery, and Means ended up being prosecuted in New York State for that. Testimony showed that the witnesses to the new will were actually out of town on the day that it was signed and couldn't have signed it. The typewriter used to make the document itself had not even been manufactured when the will purportedly was written, and King's signature and those of other witnesses were not genuine, and this was proved. Means was brought to trial, and it really wasn't going too well for him. He knew the location of a trunk filled with secret documents that he obtained from German spies. Now, in exchange for a letter to the judge attesting to his good character from the United States Army, he said he would hand over all this spy information that was in the trunk. Now, the military, considering what was going on in the world at that time, decided that, yeah, it might be a good idea to see if he is telling the truth to have that information. So they assigned an Army intelligence officer to accompany Means and to locate the trunk, which Means was able to do, and he handed it over on the condition that it be sent straight to Washington, D.C., unopened and intact. Then, with a baggage claim ticket in hand, he went off to Washington, D.C. himself and declared he had kept his end of the bargain and demanded that the promised letter attesting to his good services and in his patriotic stance be delivered. Now, it's too bad the truck arrived and it was found to contain no documents whatsoever. Actually, the trunk didn't contain much of anything. Declaring he knew who had done this, quote, despicable thing, Means promised to find the scoundrels and recover the lost papers. The Army investigated and discovered that when the trunk was taken into custody by the shipping company, the weight of the trunk was registered and logged, and it weighed the same when it was shipped as when it was opened. The box was empty before and at the time it was shipped. There were no records from German spies. The 1920 election, the first year after World War I, and the first after the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote in elections, Warren G. Harding from Ohio was elected president. This brought about many changes in the United States, and Means was there to take advantage of the changes and any cash he could get his greedy little hands on. In 1921, William J. Burns, his boss and private detective, former Secret Service agent, he was appointed to head the Justice Department's Federal Bureau of Investigations. And when he did so, he brought Means with him as an FBI agent. President Warren G. Harding, depending on who you believe or what you want to read about it, willingly or unknowingly brought along basically a crew of crooks and thieves when he came to Washington, D.C. This group would later become known in the media as the Ohio Gang. These were the men who were loosely associated with Harding's Attorney General, Harry Daugherty. Means was right at home with this group. He fit right in. Two peas in a pod, so to speak. He ended up working under a Jess Smith, a hanger-on of the Attorney General, and before long, Smith and Means were running a successful swindle in the middle of Prohibition. Means would use his skills as a detective to gather information on bootleggers, and Smith would help arrange meetings with them, during which he would offer them protection from the law, for a price, of course. Meanwhile, Justin Means collected payments that were made to him through a fishbowl that he kept in an empty hotel room into which the bootleggers and illegal alcohol manufacturers would drop by the hotel and drop cash off into that fishbowl, sometimes as much as $60,000 a day. It seemed as though the profits of corruption would never end. But little did they know that the FBI was about to receive a startling makeover. The Federal Justice Department had been given the nickname at the time, the Department of Easy Virtue. It was a perfect place for Means. A fraud and pathological liar, he loved ripping off bootleggers, or anyone else for that matter. Criminals were great victims because they had nowhere to complain to when they got ripped off. A prime opportunity came in 1922 when George Remus, perhaps one of the most successful and richest bootleggers in the country, got caught in violating the Volstead Act. Means went to this head criminal and told him he could fix his case for him and he wouldn't have to serve any time once the case was appealed. All it would cost him would be $125,000, just a drop in the bucket to this high-end bootlegger. Unfortunately, the appeal that Means was supposed to fix was overturned, and the man ended up going to prison anyway. History shows us that President Harding's administration was rife with corruption, and there were a couple of suicides that happened there. as well that helped muddy the water as far as any investigation goes. The whole thing exploded in the Teapot Dome scandal. Means often claimed to be deep in the inner circle of the Ohio gang, receiving assignments directly from the President of the United States, but that was pretty much just another one of his outlandish ideas and tales. Now, Gaston Means was suspended by the FBI in February of 1922, particularly for taking bribes to have liquor released from federal warehouses. Officially, Means was making about $7 a day at his government job, but the fact that he had three servants in his household, a couple of kids, his wife didn't work, and the fact that he rode around in a chauffeur-driven Cadillac from place to place brought a little bit of suspicion on him that something wasn't quite right. Now, although he was a scam artist and a con man, he did get some results for the FBI, so he was suspended and quickly was given a position in the Treasury Department as a customs agent. Working as a customs official while he was suspended from the Justice Department, but still able to keep the same office, all the while working with the Treasury Department. Now, in 1924, following President Harding's death, Congress held hearings on the Justice Department's role in failing to oversee their prohibition duty under the Volstead Act. Means testified against former Attorney General Daugherty, and he confessed to handling bribes for senior officials in some manner or another in the former Harding administration. He declared the country was being spoiled and that he had to do the right thing and come clean, just like a loyal American. Now, if he was a loyal American, he probably wouldn't have been ripping everybody off to begin with. Now, ever the showman and con artist, he arrived at the Senate hearing with two large accordion-style briefcases that he said were full of his diaries of all his government work, and that he had been keeping them ever since he started working for the government. He referred to them often, but he never showed them. Once asked to present the documents to the Senate committee directly, he said that he had already done so. He had given the material and another large trunk of documentation to a person who had reported to his house and said he was with the Senate Sergeant at Arms. He produced for the committee chairman the order given to him by the sergeants, who immediately declared that this was a forgery. Means jumped up out of his chair and shouted, "Forgery? I've been tricked by my enemies. I'll run them down if it's the last thing I do." Okay, well, good luck with that, Mr. Showman Bob. The material was never located, not that it probably had actually ever existed. Later, it would come out that he had hired several assistants to construct part of the material. At least the documents he was fond of carrying around in suitcases into the Senate chambers, he always had them sitting at his feet while he guarded them himself. But once again, they were constructed material, all part of his show and tell, his dog and pony show. Means got himself involved in another scam referred to as the Glass Coffin Case of 1922. The concept and idea of a glass coffin had excited an investment company in New York, and the sales ended up being pretty good. Apparently, they were quite popular. Unfortunately, the coffin company that was producing them was better at selling its concept than it was at actually making and manufacturing and delivering of the actual glass coffins. In reality, he probably would have made quite a ton of money with this particular scheme if he had only done it legally, because for some reason at that time frame the glass coffin concept was quite popular and they were selling off the shelves. But he had to take shortcuts to the big money and just basically rip people off. Now, J. Edgar Hoover who we mentioned didn't care for Means in the slightest, had been a rising star in the Federal Bureau of Investigation at that time. Now, as an honest official, he was disgusted by the blatant corruption that took place in the Justice Department during the Harding administration. And he especially loathed Means, who was known for his dirty tricks and anything for a buck activities, such as hiring a made-up investigative team, and he pocketed the money of this imaginary group salary himself. He did the same with paid informants as well. He would set up a imaginary paid informant and submit information that he read out of the newspaper as tips from this paid informant, of course pocketing the restitution from the FBI to the paid informant for his own uses. Now, the more he flim-flammed, the more Hoover got ticked off at him, and eventually prosecutors, at the encouragement and assistance of Hoover, convicted Means of violating the Volstead Act and perjury for his Senate hearing statements in 1924. He received a total sentence of 4 years and a $10,000 fine. Means was sent to the Atlanta Penitentiary, and during this time that he was staying there, the chaplain of the federal prison introduced him to a Mrs. May Dixon Thacker. And she was a True Confessions writer, magazine at the time. Dixon Thacker was also the wife of a well-known Southern evangelist, and her brother was Thomas Frederick Dixon, which you may or may not recognize. He was the author of the novel The Klansman, the later led to the silent movie The Birth of a Nation, one of the causes or influences of the rise or the resurgence of the Ku Klux Klan in the early 1920s. The writer herself, she was conducting research on prison conditions in the South at the time, and true to form, Means told her stories and made up yarns and things, anything he could do to get her confidence and attention. She took all of Means' stories to be true and eagerly told him that if he ever wanted to write a book about it, to contact her. After serving his time and being released from prison, Gustin Means, a con man, contacted the unsuspecting author, and Miss Thacker recounted Means' story in a book titled The Strange Death of President Warren G. Hardin, ghostwritten by her and credited at the time to Means himself. Written as truth, the book convinced millions of Americans that the First Lady of the United States had actually poisoned and killed her husband with the aid and assistance of his personal physician, Dr. Charles Sawyer. Means claimed the First Lady had hired him to look into the various inappropriate contacts that the president had with various women and report back to her. Unfortunately, he brought back bad news that all the rumors were true, and Means confided to Miss Thacker, his ghostwriter, that the First Lady's motive for killing her husband was to protect him from the damaging scandal which would soon come to light. The Strange Death of President Warren G. Hardin was a huge success and bestseller, and Means got a good chunk of money from the royalties for the sale of the book. Miss May, I'm afraid, didn't receive hardly anything. A counter expose published by Liberty Magazine refuted the claims laid out in the book and exposed it as being the fraud that it was. Now, true to his nature, Means, having already received his royalties and conned Miss Thacker out of hers, later came out saying basically, "Yep, I got you. I made it all up." And he did. Another con game that Means was involved with that put him back into the spotlight was when the son of Charles Lindbergh was reportedly kidnapped and missing. The story gripped the nation in a panic, and a lot of speculation as well. Means decided that he can make some money off of this. He used his connections to introduce himself to wealthy socialite Evelyn Walsh and a Mr. McLean, who was Charles Lindbergh's cousin. He convinced the socialite, Miss Walsh, that he could find the Lindbergh baby, provided that he had the cash and the necessary funds to do so. He had run into Miss McLean a couple of times, who just so happened to be the owner at that time of the Hope Diamond, from his time working in the Harding administration. He offered to act as a middleman with the kidnappers, and taking a $100,000 ransom that she was willing to pay, and wanting to help the Lindbergh family, she withdrew the money and drove to her vacation home in Aiken, South Carolina, just as Means had instructed her to do. Escaping with the money, Means had a friend feed her false information about a fantastic chase he supposedly undertook in search of the baby, who was ultimately found dead a couple of months later by the dad, Charles Lindbergh. But Justin Means' downfall came when he demanded another $35,000 to complete the search. The kidnappers, through Means, sent her on confusing cross-country trips and that were actually quite difficult to follow. Eventually, she became suspicious when Means was trying to get her to cross the U.S. border into Mexico, where he said the kidnappers were and would be willing to make a transaction there, but not in the United States. And I'm sure it wouldn't have turned out well for Mrs. McLean, considering what happened on a rabbit hunt in North Carolina several years ago. Miss McLean's lawyers eventually informed the FBI, and Edgar Hoover was more than happy to try to take Means down. Caught and put on trial, he was found guilty of larceny after trust and sentenced to another 15 years in prison. Now, at this point in his life, he suffered from poor health, estrangement from his fellow prisoners and his wife and family, and the final demise of his reputation. Before going to trial on the kidnapping con, Means claimed to have the goods on two Soviet spies who were intent on wreaking havoc in the United States, each having over $2 million earmarked for that purpose. Means claimed that if they would be light on his sentence or let him go, he would be able to locate these Soviet spies himself and get the information, which he said was in a couple of shipping crates. He claimed several times that he had almost got those trunks and crates and suitcases, and once he did so, but upon his return to New York, the secret agents that originally stole the information stole it right back from him. Finally, he delivered the news that one of the Russians had murdered the other one, and all the documents had been burned and lost. He told the story so convincingly that an arrest warrant was sworn out against one of the killers for a murder that existed only in his mind. Craziness can be contagious. On December 12, 1938, one of the most brazen swindlers of the early 20th century died in prison at the age of 59 after a series of gallbladder issues and heart failure. Means appeared as a character in a television series, Boardwalk Empire. He was a fast and loose Department of Justice investigator, which is what he was in reality. Apparently a legend in his own mind as well at the time. Well, tomorrow I hope you found the information you were looking for on our Southern gentleman. And again, I don't like calling him that because he was no gentleman, but he was from the South. And his career, though he accomplished nothing really positive in life, a lesson to others that will hopefully protect some people who come into contact with individuals like Justin Means. And those guys are still out there. They're still supporting themselves by ripping people off and running cons. And it could be something as simple as trying to sell you an extended warranty on your car. And if you live in the United States, you know what I'm talking about. And I don't know if that's the sort of thing that happens in other countries. If you know, drop me a line. I'd be happy to hear about your phone calls from the extended warranty pushers. Anyway, thank you for listening. And if you have thoughts on this podcast and would like to share them, you can contact us through the felonfile.com webpage or email us directly at felonfile@gmail.com. And if you'd be interested in copies of my books, fiction and nonfiction, and some of my other works, you can find them at Amazon and Barnes & Noble as well, with a link, of course, hooked up at the website, felonfile.com. And don't forget to check out our stuff page on the website, where you can pick up a Felon File t-shirt or a coffee mug. Nothing says, I know something you don't, better than drinking your morning coffee in front of your coworkers in a Felon File coffee mug. If you got a good idea for a Shade of Blue podcast story, that's something you'd like us to research and maybe get out there, do like Tamar did and drop us a line. We'd be happy to hear from you. You can also support the Felon File podcast by buying Victoria or me a cup of coffee from the link on the website. And that helps negate some of the expenses on research as far as getting information and FOIA requests and case file information from different agencies and the FBI, which is one of the things we used in this particular podcast. In the coming weeks, be sure to be safe and be secure. Don't let the Shade of Blue stories frighten you from doing good things and doing something nice for somebody else. It's still the right thing to do for ourselves and our community, and there's not enough of us doing those things. Well, Victoria, go ahead and close us out. I hope we didn't keep you guys too long. Don't forget to come back next Saturday for another episode and Shade of Blue story on Felon File. Talk to y'all later. Bye, y'all.
You have been listening to the Felon File podcast with your host, Scott Lunsford. For more information or Scott's books and writings, go to scottlunsfordauthor.com, felonfile.com. Scott can also be contacted at these web pages. Also, please check out our available stuff page, where you too can grab a Felon File t-shirt or coffee mug. There is also a link where you can buy us a cup of coffee that helps keep us commercial free. This is Victoria, your producer. Thank you for listening.